evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Stephen Pileski. Pileski is an artist, writer, ex-flyer, and educator. His art has been exhibited all over the world, from San Francisco to London to Barcelona to Tokyo and everywhere in between. His screen prints were purchased by numerous museums, including MoMA and the Whitney. He recently published his first book, The Balloonist, the story of T.S.C. Lowe, inventor, scientist, magician, and father of the U.S. Air Force, published by Frederick Beale Publishers. Pileski is a professor emeritus at Cornell University. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, I want to talk to you about the fact that you received a degree in economics in the late 1950s, but you're a self-taught artist, and you proceeded to concentrate on art instead of economics. Why didn't you study art?
Basically, you know, when you're young and your parents are paying the bill for your schooling, you kind of study what they want you to study. And my father had an insurance business. He had been a high school teacher, and he suddenly had this insurance business that was doing quite well. And so he gave up being a high school teacher and decided that I should take over his insurance business. It would be, you know, Pileski and Son. And so there I was, happily studying all these courses in accounting and things like that. And finally, in my junior year, I had a free elective. In those days, it seems like courses were more, programs were more rigid than nowadays. I didn't get a free elective till my junior year, so I thought I would take art. Hey, you know, I mean, my grade point average wasn't all that high anyway, and I figured, having been the editor of the school yearbook and drawing cartoons and all that in high school, this would be a snap, and I guess it would have been, but I guess the professor didn't seem to like me. I mean, this was a college in Pennsylvania for people who couldn't get into any other school anywhere else, and it was run by, I forget, Quakers or Presbyterians or something like that for Jewish kids from Long Island. And in 1957, this would be, the life models were still wearing leotards, and I said, "My God, you know, can't we even have a naked model?" And he said, "Mr. Pileski, we call them nude models here," and you know, so I didn't ingratiate myself very well, and I wasn't doing very well in the class, and I was in danger of flunking this free elective, which I couldn't afford to flunk. But in the meantime, yes, there's always that meantime. In the meantime, I had met the town artist, and in every town, there's always an artist who used to teach at the university and didn't get tenure, and now hangs around and throws barbs at the university. And being the fact that he was older and I was younger, I could also accompany him to these rowdy bars where we hung out. And
so you actually ingratiated yourself to an artist, and that's how you became an artist yourself? Because I also understand that while you were still in college studying economics, you ended up with your first one-person show.
This is true. Uh-huh. I mean, Rakowski, he's dead now, he got me interested in art, so I began to paint. Whenever I get into anything, I do it intensely. You know, so I'm painting, in the meantime, working on my hot rod and all this other kind of stuff that I'm working on. And I decided I would go to Scranton. Wilkes-Barre didn't have a museum, mind you. You know, it still doesn't, by the way. And there was the museum up there, and I went to Scranton, and there was a show of constructivists, right? White on white, black on black, nothing on nothing at all. And there was a guy standing there looking at the show, kind of short, chunky guy. And I said, "This stuff is god-awful. It has no angst." See, I was an abstract expressionist, throwing the paint, splattering it around. I indeed had angst. Of course, I should have known that the man was there looking at the show. He was the director of the museum, because in Scranton, you know, not many people are going to go to the museum anyway. So he said, "What do you know about angst?" And I said, I'm Pileski. I'm an artist in Wilkes-Barre, and I'm involved." So we had this big conversation. I told him how wonderful I was and how I had actually been in an exhibition in New York that Rakowski had gotten me invited to. And he said, "Well, you know, if your work's that wonderful, bring some up and let me look at it." So a few days passed, and I brought some things up, and lean them up against my customized 55 Plymouth convertible that I'm glad they were big paintings. See, I had to have the top down anyway. It was summertime. They were too big to fit into the car.
I could just picture you driving down the street with these.
Yeah, they kind of bent, you know, they bent. But the good thing about the paintings, I didn't want them to see my car because I thought, you know, artists are supposed to have like Volkswagen buses with peace signs on and stuff like that. And to have a powder blue Plymouth convertible customized, it would ruin my image. But anyway, he really liked this stuff, and he said, "How many more do you have?" Well, of course, you know, I was an economics major, so I said, "Oh, how many more do I have?" I didn't reveal that all I had was what he was currently looking at, but told him to come in a few weeks, and I would show him the rest. And so on the way back from Scranton, I stopped, bought these huge rolls of canvas, these stretcher bars, and proceeded to make a whole exhibition to fill his room, which he showed me that
fill. So he did finally let you have an exhibit, and it was a success, I take it.
Well, it was a success in that it was a scandal. Of course, in Scranton, it doesn't take much to make a scandal, but the fact that...
you keep making fun of Scranton. We're going to hear from people.
Anyway, people rushed to see this show because it was not what people were expecting.
So tell us why it was a scandal in those days. Were you doing nudes or?
No, it was abstract expressionism. There were these giant 6-foot by 8-foot canvases. I'd go up on the roof of our house and my sister would be down below and I'd say, "A little more to the right, Mary Ellen," and phew, I would throw this bucket of paint down. And then I would go down there and beat it with sticks and maybe throw some sand on it and slash it and bandage it.
So was this prior to Jackson Pollock?
No, this was at the same time as Jackson Pollock. But, you know, Jackson Pollock is not about to take time out from his busy schedule in the world to come to Scranton. And so they had this kind of Scranton, you know, imitator, Pulaski, who is bringing the New York scene to...
We don't want to run out of time here. You have so much to talk about. You opened a screen printing studio in New York, one of the first in the country.
That's
true. So tell us how that came about and all the artists that you met and so on.
Okay, yeah. I was in New York and I was just about running out of money and I was living in a storefront at 614 East 11th Street, $25 a month, rat infested.
Of course.
In the house that I had lived in previously, I was across the street, actually across the hall from Alfred Jensen, who was having this show at the Guggenheim. And so Alfred said, "Do you know anything about silk screen prints?" And I said, "Yes, indeed I did," because that was another thing I had taught myself in Pennsylvania from a book that was given out by the Sherwin-Williams Paint Company, Sherwin-Williams Technical Reference Manual, number 28. it was true because, you know, then I didn't have to go to the printing class and use their printing presses and all those doodads. I could make this stuff at home. Anyway, so I made these 4 big prints for Jensen. I still have copies of them. We might be showing them here in Ithaca next year. I'm working with the ink shop folks. We're trying to put up a show called Pulaski and Friends, dragging out all these old Lichtensteins, Rosenquists, Alex Katzes, and stuff that I have.
And then, so those are the artists that actually came to you to do silk prints.
Oh, yeah, Motherwell,
you had Andy Warhol.
Yeah, we didn't do too many Warhols. Andy had his own people working, but I did advise him. I remember when he was printing the Brillo boxes, Andy calls up and he says, "Steve, well, when I'm over at your shop, you're printing. It goes on for hours." You said, "We're trying to print these Brillo boxes. I print one or two and the screen dries up." So I asked him, you know, "What's the temperature? Do you have the windows open? Is there a fan?" He went through all this stuff. So finally, I said, "What kind of paint are you using?" He said, "Well, we're using Liquitex." And at that time, you know, this is like white latex house paint, instantly drying. And what you're supposed to use for printing is the oleoresinous paint. So we did help him out now and then. But and I did print a number, the big ticket that he did and the Paris Review poster and a bunch of other things.
But you eventually, you gave up this business and you came to Ithaca and started teaching at Cornell. And that's where you proceeded to decide to learn to fly. Tell us about that.
Okay, I always wanted to fly. As a kid, I flew model airplanes, and I did, you know, these little contests with planes on string, and you had stunt flying competitions. So now here I was at Cornell. The most wonderful thing about being at Cornell, of course, was every second Friday, money appeared in my checking account. And so unlike, you know, at Chiron Press, where I was responsible to see that everything was paid, even the accountant got paid, sometimes I didn't get paid. Now I can take these flying lessons. Of course, the problem was there was only one flying school in Ithaca at that time, Chart Air, and I remember the words of the famous Alan Hayes when he drummed me out of his flying school saying, "Pulaski, you are a menace to yourself and everyone around you, and you have no business being in an airplane." And so what can
I do? Now tell us why he said that. What were you doing? Were you hot dogging it or what?
No, I was very nice. I was flying very nicely. I thought I was very polite. I don't know why he didn't like me. Poor Alan, he's passed away too. I mean, if he were alive, he probably would be on the phone right now saying, "I don't like that Pulaski because," you know, he'd tell you. But the only way I could fly is you had to buy your own airplane. And so if you bought your airplane, then, you know, nobody could tell you what to do because it was your airplane. They couldn't tell you, you couldn't go. And so I went down to Pennsylvania to visit my parents, and I happened to see this Belanca Citabria, which was a stunt plane, sticking its nose out of a hangar there with a for sale sign on it. I said, "This is wonderful," you know. So I asked the guy. They told me the price. We negotiated, and it was a tailwheel airplane, like an old-fashioned plane. Remember, they used to have little wheels in the back and two big wheels in the front, which I had never learned. I had learned on the regular airplane with the little nose wheel in the front. And so finally we agreed the guy's going to sell it to me, and he took me up and he demonstrated all these stunts he could do. That was wonderful. I thought this, you know, because I'd never flown upside down before, done a loop-de-loop and all that stuff.
Oh, my goodness, I would be scared to death.
Oh, yeah, well, I was scared, but, you know, this is what I wanted to do, and so I bought the plane. So now I said, "Excuse me, but I have to take it home." And when you're a student, you can't go more than 50 miles from your base. So I said, "Excuse me, please, could you sign this logbook authorizing me to go 50 miles from my base to get the plane home?" Because, you know, it was 150 or 200 miles or something. He said, "Excuse me." I said, "Well, yeah, I just have a student, and I need to get my airplane home. So you've got to sign this, please."
A great BSer, weren't you?
He said, "You're just a student?" I said, "Yes, you know, please." So he said, "Well, you know," he was afraid now he's going to lose the sale or something. So he said, "Okay," he signed it off. So then he signed it off. I said, "Can you sign it off for unlimited cross country?" And so then I could go wherever I want, maybe whenever I wanted. But he didn't go so that far. But I flew this plane home, landed it, and they were putting it in the hangar there, which is right next to the flying school. And I remember Mr. Hayes coming out and saying, "Pulaski, there's a plane. If you ever become a pilot, there's the kind of plane you're going to want. That's a real pilot's plane, a stunt plane." And I said, "Oh, Mr. Hayes, it is my plane. I just bought it, and I brought it home." And he looked at me and said, "Pulaski, what I would do is I'd see if you could get someone to buy that plane off of you before you get into too much trouble with it."
But you ended up actually starting an aerial performance company and so on. To tell us a little bit about that, and then tell us about this UFO experience that you said you experienced up in Northern California.
Okay. Yeah. For a while I took time out for art just to learn to become a stunt flyer. And I had the Citabria, which was kind of like a trainer stunt flyer. Then the Decathlon, which is kind of like an intermediate. And then finally, I decided I needed to go for a Pitt Special, which was the ultimate stunt flying plane. Now, what I wanted to do is I didn't want to be just some kind of art professor flopping around in the sky. I've involved in many things, and I try to get to the highest level that I could possibly get. And so I started to fly in aerobatic competitions. I flew in sportsman, intermediate, then finally advanced. And in 1977, I won the Canadian Open Advanced Championship. So I said that, you know, now I could be prepared to do this aerial theater, this art in the sky. I wouldn't be just some amateur art professor flopping around in the sky. But if I designed something that I wanted to create, I could be able to execute it in the way that I thought it needed to be done.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Pulaski. Pulaski is an artist, writer, ex-flyer, and educator. Let's continue the talk about your flying and your aerial performances. Tell us about the UFO that you saw when you were flying up in Sonoma.
Okay, so I was doing these aerial theater performances here and there and here and there, and I was invited out to the University of California, Berkeley. Again, probably because I had just had a show in San Francisco that had gotten outrageous reviews, and people were questioning why I was doing these paintings of wings and things like that. And so while I was there, I did several performances. And the one I did in Sonoma. It was Cal State Sonoma, which is really in Roanoke Park. So I'm flying. I'm doing this thing. I come there. I do my stuff. It was in the middle of the afternoon. At noon, there were tens of thousands, because the whole campus was out and the town was watching. And so now it's all over. I land. I pick me up. They go back. You go out for lunch with the faculty. And one of the friends of mine from Berkeley was up there. He said, Steve, he was from England, by the way, just what was this white thing that you brought around with you for the performance? I said, I didn't bring any white thing. And everyone says, there was this big white circle that kept following you around during the performance. I said, no, it wasn't mine. And I remember flying. I pulled a loop, and I was going to line up with what I thought was a white lozenge-shaped mansion on Sonoma Mountain. So now I pull up, over invert it, and when I come around, if the loop is correct, I should line up with that shape again. I looked, it wasn't there. I said, wow, did I screw up? I come around. So I'm doing my thing, you know, because I'm going between 80 and 140, 160 miles an hour, and the decision time is very precise and everything, you know. And so you look around, you see, and it's, oh, some fool is over there, another small plane. But then I didn't recognize it was sort of a white thing. So now, boom, I stop what I'm doing. I come up, and this white thing goes, and boom. So they say at lunch, yes, this white thing, we have it on video. And so we go, and we look at it, and there it is on video, a real UFO. And this has been documented on the video. It's in Jeffrey Mishloff's book, PK Man. He devotes about a paragraph to it, because at the same time, apparently, there was some prophet of UFOs, Ted Owen, I think, predicted that a UFO was going to appear in Northern California, and it was going to be seen by many, many people. And he predicted it almost by time, according to Jeffrey Mishloff's book. I mean,
wow,
I don't
that's
know.
That's amazing. That's really an amazing story. Now, before we do run out of time, we have to talk about your recently published book, The Balloonist. Tell us how you got interested in Thaddeus T.C. Lowe, the father of the Air Force.
Well, it was curious. It says on the jacket it's my first novel, which is not true. It is actually my sixth novel, five of which nobody has bothered to publish, even though they have been badgered considerably.
But before you start talking about this, it's a historical fiction or is it biography? Because it says both.
Hey, this is why it's been published by a small independent publisher in Savannah. The publisher himself used to work for Scribner's and started this about 10 years ago. In the United States today, categories are very important. Hey, is it a historical novel? Hey, is it a biography? It's not a biography because it doesn't have footnotes. It is a biography because it's absolutely historical accurate.
Mm-hmm.
All the facts check out.
Okay.
It's not a novel because it doesn't have dialogue. Why didn't I put dialogue in it? Because people don't talk that way anymore, and I would have had to make up the dialogue. Mm-hmm. Lowe writes, at one point he sends a telegram down to Abe Lincoln on the ground. He addresses Abe Lincoln as Your Excellency. I mean, would I send a telegram to Bush addressing it, Your Excellency? And then in the end, he signs it, Your Obedient Servant. Hey, another thing that I probably wouldn't have done. And so I decided it would be better to leave out the dialogue. So you get one editor or one agent saying, well, I would really like this book, but if you would write in dialogue. Well, I'm not going to write in dialogue. But you need to put in footnotes. You've put in too much of your emotion in it. You've made up too much of Lowe's emotion. I mean, in my mind, I saw Lowe as a pacifist. Why did I see Lowe as a pacifist? Because he quit. In the middle of the Civil War, he quit. Why did he quit? Because one reason, in the Peninsula Campaign, the war could have ended. The war could have ended when they had Richmond surrounded. Lowe went up in his balloon. He looked down and he said to McClellan, there aren't that many Confederate forces there. Attack. McClellan, if you know, never wanted to attack. And so what's happening? He's sending telegrams to Lincoln. Send me more troops, more troops, more troops, more troops. Mm-hmm. What happens? Southern troops build up. Comes Robert E. Lee. Comes Johnston. They counterattack, drive the Union Army right off the peninsula. There's Savage's Station, Gaines Mills, all these battles they lost. I mean, the Civil War could have been over almost 3 years sooner.
Yeah, and you made that clear in the book that Thaddeus Lowe was really uncomfortable with the carnage and the wasted lives and so on. But so he invented these balloons, and he talked the army during the Civil War into using them.
Yeah.
To spy on the enemy,
right.
Or on the opposition,
He talked Lincoln. The army was very much against it.
But they still allowed him to do it.
They allowed him to do it, but again, they kind of patronized him at Fredericksburg. If you remember in the book, they put him way, way off in the distance. He was sending one report, look, we're losing. And the army's sending up these telegrams, yeah, hey, well, we're winning, we're whipping these guys, you know. And so this is why he became very, very, very disillusioned. And
He's not very well known to the general public, but he did so much. These original balloons used in the first war. He invented the ice machine, one of the first ice machines. He did railroading in Southern California. So how did you even find out about him?
My wife, Jean Mackin, who's also a writer, one day brought this book home from a used bookstore, and it was Thaddeus Sobieski Konstantin Lowe, and because it had this Polish name, she said, have you ever heard of this guy? I said, no, I've never heard of it. And I read the book, and it was a very interesting book, and it was printed in 1958. And I began to, I began to look around quite honestly. Before 9/11, I'd written a book about Lindbergh being a fraud. But this was pure fiction. Or maybe it was, the more I researched it, he landed in Nova Scotia and picked up a little kid who knew how to fly. I had a whole big story. This kid learned how to fly with his uncle in the Midwest and flew across the Atlantic with him and then landed, and the kid got out, and then he landed. So now comes 9/11. Nobody wants anti-hero books. At least, nobody wanted it before 9/11. Nobody really wanted it now. I said, what kind of book can I write that approaches being an American hero as close as I can get? And Lowe came back to my mind, and so I began to look up Lowe. And it was funny, at the time when I began this book, if you went to the internet and you did a search for T.S.C. Lowe, nothing would come up. Now if you go to Lowe, you find a lot of things. Of course, a lot of references are to my book, but now his entire papers are on the internet. When I began the book, you had to go down to the Smithsonian Institution, put on white gloves, and look at them in a box.
But I was going to say, his stuff did end up in the Smithsonian, so that's quite something in itself.
But if you remember in the book, they didn't even take him until way along. I forget the exact date.
Well, it wasn't good for his life, but it's good for us.
Yeah, it's good for us.
He was acknowledged that way.
In the papers, though, there were a lot of things that were not quite right either, because he wrote them when he was 93 and just about to pass away. And I find things like, for example, he describes this wonderful flight, this ascension he did in Philadelphia for Admiral Byrd and Admiral Perry Byrd. I'm getting out of date here. Perry, who opened up Japan, and the Japanese ambassador. And so I said, well, this is great. I'll put this in here. I get some descriptions of Commodore Perry, and so I look up Perry and find out that he's already been dead for 2 years when Lowe is imagining that he has flown for this guy.
So, interesting.
So I had there were a lot of things that I had to kind of juggle around
He was fictionalizing his own life in some ways toward the end, perhaps.
Yeah. And then even these big controversies when I did the signing in Washington D.C. last week. Some relations of the Allen brothers came up. And if you remember when you read the book, there was this controversy between him and the Allen brothers and John Weiss. And, in the book, he really duns these guys. I mean, in his papers, I tried to be a little nicer toward the Allen brothers than perhaps he was. But the Allen brothers family came up to me, and they were asking me about it. Of course, they hadn't read the book. Maybe when they've read the book, they might not be so happy about it.
Well, you were trying to be somewhat accurate. Now, let's talk about what you're doing now as an artist. You've gotten into digital photography. How did that happen?
It was curious because the publisher took 4 years to bring this book out. He said it would be a very nice book, and it is. I mean, it's a nice hardcover.
It's a very interesting
good
book.
Paper,
I would really recommend it to my listeners, yeah.
Oh, thank you. And so, 4 years was passing, and I'd written several other books in the meantime, And when you query an editor or you query an agent, it's like, well, you know, you say, I'm publishing this book, but I don't know when. But anyway, I always had distractions. My mind is always distracted by something, probably because if I find a goal that's unattainable, I will look for another goal that's more immediate and attainable.
Mm.
But the true fact was, I also, when I retired from Cornell, I got a grant. And the easiest way to spend this grant is to go to the campus store and buy stuff. Otherwise, you got to save receipts, drag them home. And So now here I was left with a grand sum of money left, and the grant was about to run out. And so I went to the campus store. What could I buy? What will take this away in a chunk of money? And there was this grand Olympus EM10 digital camera with all kinds of doodads and googads and a book that was almost an inch thick of instructions. And so I bought it. And I took it home, and I said, now, in order to make this, figure out how this works, what should I do? So I set up still lifes with different light and different things in different light, and I start photographing these still lifes, you know, using the various controls and things like that, and then I showed them to some people, and suddenly it was, so wow, this is... These still lifes go back to like 17th century
they
Dutch
do.
Landscapes.
I was going to tell you that,
like that,
Steve. Honestly, yeah. I saw some pictures of them on your website. Yeah. They're gorgeous.
Oh, thank you.
They look like paintings from the Dutch era,
yeah,
you know, Rembrandt.
From Dutch landscape painters.
Yeah.
So I start taking these, and of course, this is, you know, the profligacy of a digital camera. Suddenly, I had like 1,000 images, you know. And here you go, and you're editing them down, and you're making them, and they're going, and then... I talked to the people at the upstairs gallery who were happy to have a show. And then at the present moment, I have 5 or 6 in a show in New York at the Terrain Gallery. But this was a gallery I knew from years ago. And they've actually been around for 50 years. And they were having their 50th anniversary. And they wrote me up and said, you know, do you have something you could send us? And so I sent them some of these new photographs for the 50th anniversary show. They're expecting to get more of the same old that they had years ago. And they were very excited about it because they sold a bunch. And so then they put up a photography show, which is up now. And it's been going very well, apparently.
That's great that you've gotten into the modern day technology. That's terrific. Well, we have run out of time, Stephen Pileski. Thank you so much for joining us. And I do recommend to my listeners, pick up a copy of The Balloonist. It's a fascinating piece of our history that a lot of us have never heard about. So thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, and thank you for the interview. And I'm glad that you enjoyed the book.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.